Long before she became an internationally renowned linguist at Georgetown University and the best-selling author of the groundbreaking book about women and men you just don't understand, Deborah Tannen was a young girl who deeply adored her father, Eli Tannen, profoundly influenced by his gift for writing and storytelling. In her debut memoir, Finding My Father, His Century-Long Journey from World War I Warsaw and My Quest to Follow, Tannen embarks on the poignant yet perilous quest to piece together the puzzle of her father's life, uncovering secrets not even she could have expected. Secrets that forced Tannen to rethink her assumption about her father's life, her parents' marriage, and the story she for decades told herself about her parents' love story. Again, the name of the book is Finding My Father, His Century-Long Journey from World War I Warsaw and My Quest to Follow. It is published by Ballantine. And we welcome Deborah Tannen to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
Good. So nice to talk to you.
Wonderful to talk to you. I thank you very much for taking the time out. So what led you to want to take on this task?
As you said in the introduction, I adored my father. When I was a kid, he was almost never around. Like many fathers, I guess, either was away working. He was also very active in politics. So Sundays he would be there. After he retired, he had more time, and he talked really, I could almost say obsessively, about his history in Warsaw. He was born in Warsaw in 1908, came to this country when he was 12 in 1920. And I began spending time with him listening to those stories. And then the project really gradually expanded to really questions about his whole life. And some of it was that. And then the other was the feeling that his life was like a walking tour through history. He had lived through World War I in Warsaw, and he was a part of the Hasidic community there. Then he came to this country. There was the Depression. He had to quit high school at 14. He had no father, so to support his mother and sister. Worked in a factory and yet managed to become a lawyer by going to law school at night. And then the Depression, which made it impossible for him to really make a living as a lawyer until he was 50. All the jobs that he did in between. And then, as you mentioned, the story of why he married my mother and not another woman, whom both my parents talked about. They referred to her as my mother's rival. And he once said, when we were talking, one of our many, many, many long conversations that I taped, your mother wasn't my girlfriend. Helen was my girlfriend. Well, that posed a mystery. Why did he marry my mother and not the woman who was his girlfriend, Helen?
When did you start in that point of saying, okay, how much of what I thought I knew didn't I know, and that you of how you felt misguided by all of this?
Yeah, I don't know that I would ever say I felt misguided, but I did feel intrigued and mystified. Let's go back to the very, very beginning of their marriage. There was a beautiful wedding picture that was always in the house, and they were young. They were 22 and 24 when they married, and it came out in conversation with my father. He said, "Oh, well, that picture wasn't taken at our wedding." someone he knew who was a photographer heard they had no wedding picture, so he said, "I'll take one." And it turns out that that beautiful dress my mother was wearing and the gorgeous white gloves that went up past her elbow, those were bought for the picture, not for the wedding. So that kind of insight, you really don't ask questions when you're young. I knew that my parents had married on impulse because my father felt he could not marry. He was responsible for supporting his mother and sister. It was the Depression. There was no way he could support another family. But because they were having, and this is a whole interesting side story of the whole thing, I think that they were having sex, and so he had felt that was okay because it wasn't her first experience. He would never be responsible for deflowering a woman and then not marrying her. But still, they had become involved, and she became quite upset that they weren't getting married. And so he decided that his obligation to her was greater than to his mother and sister. So that kind of complexity of what relationships were like at the time, just it was not so much that I felt secrets had been kept from me as that I hadn't understood what life was like at that time. I was still thinking of a current, the way I think about marriage. You pick the person who you think is going to be a soulmate, your companion through life. But that was the Depression. There was no safety net. And so it was really all about, for him, his obligation first to his mother and sister, and then the obligation he would have to a family.
Mm. Your father became a successful lawyer, but he never graduated from high school. And it took him a long time to achieve that success that he sought.
Yes. And that is something, again, I didn't really understand until the conversations I had with him. And also, he loved the idea of my writing this book. And so he was helping me by writing detailed memories. And he had a phenomenal memory it's a little bit of a side point, but when he sat down to write his life, what he did was make a list of all the jobs he had held. And it came to 68. Wow. That was his view of his life. You know, my thought was it was all about relationships, you know, his relationship with his mother, his relationship with my mother. But for him, it was this desire to have a profession. And when he quit high school at 14, everyone told him this was crazy. You're never going to be a lawyer. But he took high school courses one by one, passed equivalency tests, passed a test for a law school qualifying certificate, endured incredible hardship, working 12-hour days in the factory, rushing to law school, having dinner at 10:30 at night, then first studying his law books, getting a couple of hours sleep, and starting again the next day. And there were no unions for the level at which he was working. So he had to work all day Saturday as well for no extra pay. But he was sure that once he got that law degree and passed the bar, he would be a lawyer and all that would be behind him. But then the Depression is what kicked in there. And I think that is so relevant to today in a way. I mean, this book coming out in a pandemic, I worked on it for so many years. In a way, it seems so ironic to me that it would come out in this pandemic. But on the other hand, it's very relevant in a way how world events and especially economic disasters like the Depression and like what we're suffering now, has such profound effects on people's lives. So, yeah, there were no jobs for lawyers. There was no way he could simply build up a practice when he was responsible for supporting a family. And I think that explains, too, something that I really came to appreciate more about my father, learning about his history. I had no idea how bitterly he resented the first 13 years of my life he was working as a cutter in a coat factory. Mm. He didn't complain about it. He never talked with any negative feelings that I perceived about the work, about his fellow workers. They were his friends. But again, these conversations that we had later, I asked him, he lived to be 98, and that's part of why his whole story is so comprehensive. I asked, well, how did you feel about those years in the factory? He said, I hated every minute of it. So he kept secret how he felt about it to protect his family, and it was effective. I mean, I appreciate that. But we did grow up, both my sisters and I, with a perception of his regret that he had made bad decisions so that his life might have turned out. He might not have had to spend those 13 years working in the factory had he made other decisions.
It seems that something else that comes out in the book is his father died from TB when he was very small. That fact that he really did not have a father seems central to him.
Absolutely. And it's one more way that he never complained. I mean, I said to him once, "No, Daddy, you never complain." He said, "I tried complaining once. It didn't help." He had a witty way of putting things. But actually, I think that dominated just about everything about his life. His mother complained so bitterly about having been left with two small children. His father left the family when my father was two and his older sister was 3 and a half because of the tuberculosis. This is back in Warsaw. He moved out because he had gotten sick and died a few years after that. My father felt that it was really his obligation to make that up to his mother because she talked about him and his sister as being the great burden. One of the totally amazing things that I read and that came as a shock to me, I always assumed he quit high school at 14 because he had to. There was just no question. But it turned out that his mother had opposed it and had tried everything she could think of to stop him from doing that. And that's especially surprising because he never challenged his mother. One of my uncles once told me that he was terrified of his mother and that if he wanted to do something she didn't approve of, he would keep it secret. If she found out about it, he wouldn't do it. He would never incur her wrath. But this was one decision he made despite her adamant disapproval. And I think I could come to understand it because of that sense of obligation that he felt he had to make up to her the loss of his father. I think he missed a father more than he admitted. Mm. He once said to me, "Yeah, well, I never had a father and I didn't miss one because I didn't know what it was to have a father. But you had a father and you missed him," which is in a way one of the points of my book. But he once made a comment that really was, I think, revealing to me. Many of the stories that he told about his past were kind of heartbreaking, and one was before he quit and supported the family, his mother had a job working as a matron in an orphan home in Tuckahoe, New York, and so he and his sister were boarders somewhere. And his bedroom, he had no bedroom, he slept on a cot in a hallway in the cellar. And the woman who they were boarding with caught him reading late at night. He always loved reading and loved words and also dealt with insomnia his whole life. So she didn't want him to waste electricity, and so she put in a blue bulb. And he commented, "It didn't stop me from reading, but that's what happens when a boy doesn't have a father. A father might have prevented me reading, but he wouldn't have put in a blue bulb." Mm. Something about there was nobody to watch out for him. And I think he did feel that way his whole life.
Deborah Tannen is our guest in the roundtable this morning. The new book, Finding My Father, His Century-Long Journey from World War I Warsaw and My Quest to Follow. You write in the book, "Daddy, I asked my father when he's old, do you feel more American or more Polish? He says, I feel like a Jew." The sixth chapter of the book is titled, "I Feel Like a Jew." Talk a little bit about that, of that feeling and how it guided him.
Yes, that was such a revealing comment that he made. And the fact that he was raised in a Hasidic family, they were Hasidim, they were ultra-Orthodox Jews. When he came to this country, he already identified, he told me, in our conversations, as an atheist and a communist. And those two things went together. I think it's hard for us to understand now how at the beginning, the birth of the Bolshevik Revolution and the beginning of communism, and he was influenced because he was there at its birth in Eastern Europe, in Warsaw, at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. They really believed this was idealism. This was going to be a classless society. There would be no discrimination, prejudice, because all the workers would unite in a common goal, the betterment of mankind. And he was caught up in that, very influenced by an older, a sister, his mother's youngest sister, who was more like his older sister than an aunt. She was only 6 years older. So that was kind of a mystery. How did he get from that ultra-Orthodox background to atheism? He gave up communism, never gave up atheism, and never gave up his Jewish identity. It is key to so much of what happened in his life, and one of the great regrets of his life, in a way, is tied up with his experience of anti-Semitism. It was a position that he really loved, a job that he loved, and he had been promised a significant promotion, but he gave up that job for one that paid somewhat more, that in the end didn't work out, because he felt that no Jew would be promoted to that rank, and he was assured that he would, and he just didn't believe it was possible. And then it turned out the person who had gotten his job was then promoted to that high rank. I'm not saying specifically what it was because it's such a fascinating story. It was a warden of the prison, the Danbury Federal Penitentiary in Danbury, Connecticut. And so that was the tremendous regret that was like a shroud over our entire family, really, that all those 13 years working as a cutter in a factory, he could have been warden, and all the respect and the interest that job would have held for him. So it all is intertwined with his sense of what it meant to be a Jew. He was always very proud of being Jewish. He taught us to be proud of being Jewish. And he was, I think, thoroughly Jewish. And a fascinating insight I came away with, and I have to credit my sister Naomi with pointing this out to me, that he gave up Hasidism, but he was in many ways still approaching the world through that lens. The tremendous value placed on kindness and good deeds that is characteristic of Hasidic orthodoxy. And by the way, a little tiny side point, some people in the audience may have followed, there was a lot of, the Hasidic community today in upstate New York, which they apparently did not observe social distancing and came down with coronavirus at a tremendous rate. Right. But then they went to extreme lengths to donate plasma, because the doing of good deeds is very fundamental to Hasidism. Well, every person that I talked to about my father said he was kind. That was one of his most noticeable characteristics. And just one last funny observation that was my sister Naomi that pointed out to me. He ridiculed religion for its rituals. And he said, oh, you have to say a prayer for everything. You say a prayer when you wash your hands. You say a prayer when you go to the toilet. And then he, in this country, would say things like, we are so lucky that we have everything here is so convenient. You just open the tap and you get delicious running clean water. And we have flush toilets in the house. So that stance of gratitude for everything that you have is also really fundamentally Hasidic.
In the few moments that we have left, so let's talk about you. The name of the book is Finding My Father. But what did you find out about yourself through that quest?
Yes, well, I came to understand things like why I also am so inclined to regret where that came from in my father's life, and much more gratefully, that so much of my whole career, which is all about language, listening to the subtle overtones of meaning, and when people talk, that really traces to him too. The love of language, an example that kind of captures that. It was from him that I learned always to have a dictionary nearby, because any word that you aren't sure of its pronunciation or its meaning, you go check it out in the dictionary. And of course, now the dictionary is in my phone. It's not a big book across the room, but every time I do check a word, I think of him, and I kind of miss that walk across the room to the dictionary, because I always felt my father was walking with me on that trip to the dictionary, and I kind of miss him beside me checking the phone. But yeah, I feel that I can trace so much of my love of language, of reading, and that very careful listening to the meanings of words when people talk to each other, I traced to him. And I guess most significantly, I would say that writing this book has allowed me to stay in conversation with him so many years after he's gone. And now he's in the book, and so he stays with me forever.
Which is beautiful. The name of the book is Finding My Father, His Century-Long Journey from World War I Warsaw and My Quest to Follow. It is published by Ballantine Books. Deborah Tannen, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Finding My Father. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.